Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Lahav Harkov, diplomatic correspondent for the Jerusalem Post, and I'm here with Yaakov Katz, editor-in-chief, as every week, to talk about the latest things in the news. And we are here on the week after Israel has finally passed a budget for the first time in 3 years.
Congratulations, Lahav.
Well, you know, actually, I mean, it's the first time that I wasn't like staying up all night with the votes and like being in the Knesset. So it was actually not so crazy for me because I'm not Knesset reporter anymore.
But for the country, it's a good thing, right? The
fact
that finally there's a budget, ministries have a lot of money that they can spend on behalf and to, I guess, help the people of Israel. And government ministries can also do long-term strategic planning, forward thinking of what they will need, not today, but in a year or two or three, and start to get those processes rolling.
Right. So the thing that I think is important to point out, the last budget vote was 3 years ago. We've not had a budget since 2019. Through this whole sort of cycle of one election after another,
you mean
after
years
another.
Of insanity?
Exactly.
Yes.
So for most of it, we did not, or for about half of it, we did not have a budget. And yeah, and there was no long-term planning. And we see this in a lot of different areas, whether, you know, day-to-day things like transportation and building roads and infrastructure, or, you know, in greater strategic things like Iran, which we'll get to later. But certainly Prime Minister Bennett has said that in the last couple, like our Iran planning had not caught up with reality, and that the army was not properly funded to plan to defend Israel from Iran as it stands now. So very important.
By the way,
the
part of that had to do with the budget. I had a briefing with a very senior IDF officer a few weeks ago who said that after the United States pulled out of the Iran deal in 2018, Israel had suspended its preparations for a possible strike against Iran once the deal went into effect in 2015. America pulls out in 2018, and then we go to all these four elections, right, without a budget. And because there was no budget, we couldn't re-up as a country our preparations for another possible strike against Iran. So what had been put on ice in 2015 continued on ice until now. Now that there's a budget, Israel can allocate the money and start to buy the munitions and the aircraft and whatever else it might need to get ready for a possible action on Iran. But more importantly, before we dive into Iran, the fact is that now there's a budget, you know, in Hebrew, there's a saying, right, Acharei Chagim, right? So everyone comes August, then comes Rosh Hashanah, and everyone's like, okay, we'll deal with that after the Chagim, after Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, and then Acharei Chagim come, and you got to start working, right? And that's usually when school starts and when businesses really come back in a big way because they've been off over the summer and over the Chagim. Now we're Acharei HaTaktiv, right? We're after the budget. And everyone had said that after the budget, the big issues are going to come out, right? And we're starting to see, you've been writing a bit about the tension with the Biden administration. What's that about?
Yeah, so first of all, after the budget was supposed to sort of, the Americans at least viewed it as a point at which this government will be stable. That if this government can pass a budget, it'll probably last much longer. Now, I think it's not a bad theory, but it is just a theory. It is also possible that, you know, this government was waiting for the budget. And like you said, now all the big issues will come out. So, you know, the budget does not necessarily mean this coalition is safe. But anyway, the Americans saw it that way and more or less had been holding off on putting a lot of pressure on Israel, you know, saying its position, whether it's being against settlements, whether wanting to open a consulate for the Palestinians in Jerusalem, but not doing
pushing
it too much.
Hard, right.
And then as of a couple of weeks ago, they started to really push, especially when it came to settlements. Also, Israel declared, as we discussed at length last or 2 weeks ago, declared six Palestinian NGOs to be part of a terrorist organization, you know, and America came back, turned around, guns blazing, so to speak, and really came out against those moves. More recently, the Israeli cybersecurity company NSO has been added to a sort of blacklist of companies that go against America's national security interests. And apparently, Israeli officials were blindsided by it, that they were only given a warning of like a couple of hours.
Right. Kind of like the Americans claimed they were blindsided by the designation of the NGOs as terrorist organizations, right? So maybe it's even a quid pro quo. But the fact is that we saw on Saturday night, when Bennett, Lapid, and Lieberman held their Acharei HaTaktiv, right, after the budget press conference party, here in Jerusalem, and they both, Bennett and Lapid, came out unequivocally and I would say in a united front against the idea of opening a consulate in Jerusalem for the Palestinians. And that's something that the Biden administration wants to do.
Yeah. First of all, I think that it's sort of the most unequivocal and the biggest sort of statement that Bennett has made.
Also.
Most public, right. Well, I mean, so Bennett gave an interview to interviews to the New York Times and the Times of London in the past couple of months. And he sort of has said things along the lines of, you know, Jerusalem is only the capital of Israel and things like that. This time he was asked the question and he had to say right there up front, I oppose the consulate. Right. And then Lapid chimed in and said the same thing that, you know, Jerusalem, I believe it was Lapid who said Jerusalem is only the capital of one country and that's Israel.
Do you think the Americans are going to go all the way with this, though?
I don't know. I mean, recently, the person at the State Department who's like in charge of, I think it was like logistics and things like that, you know, he was speaking at, I think it was the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee, and he was asked about it. And he said, you know, you can't open a consulate unless the like host country agrees to it.
Right.
And since the U.S. considers Israel the host country when it comes to Jerusalem, legally they can't really do it.
Although Nir Barkat,
even by American law.
Nir Barkat, who's a leading Likud member and potential candidate to replace Netanyahu in the future, at least that's the way he sees himself, has made a whole campaign about the U.S. consulate and has traveled to the United States and lobbied members of Congress. He has said what would stop him from just flipping the sign on the Agron Street building right now, which is now an embassy, and just changing the sign to read consulate?
I mean, technically, it's not hard to do, right? But it violates like the Vienna principles on which international diplomacy is, you know, was created. And it violates the U.S. I don't know if it's U.S. law or if it's like the bylaws of the State Department or what exactly, but it violates like Americans' own ideas of how it should work to do it against Israel.
Here's my feeling is that, okay, so Israel's lying or marking its line in the sand.
Yeah. Well, I should clarify. That doesn't mean that, I mean, I do think the Biden administration will put a lot of pressure on Israel. I just don't think that they'll do it while Israel says no.
Well, so that's the thing, right? So Israel's saying no, Biden wants it. Israel's building in settlements. Biden doesn't want them to. Biden's going to negotiations with the Iranians. Israel has its concerns about that. So everyone's kind of like jostling and marking their line in the sand and what they're willing to do, what they're not willing to do. At the end of the day, though, the way it usually works between countries is that they'll have to sit down and they'll have to negotiate terms. So, you know, the Biden folks will say to the Bennett folks, okay, you don't want a consulate, no problem. You got to put a freeze on settlement construction. Oh, you don't want a freeze on settlement construction? Okay, let's talk about exactly how that's going to work out. Maybe they'll try to get Bennett to meet Abu Mazen. You know, Israel will say, you know, we're okay. Yeah, you want to go talk to the Iranians? No problem. But we want ABC. Oh, you want ABC? Okay, so then give us the consulate. It's a back and forth, right? And the countries are going to have to just go into all these issues as one and look at them at where ultimately everybody can get something that they can say, okay, we succeeded.
Yeah, you're not wrong about that. I mean, Bennett and his people seem to think that like agree to disagree is like something you can actually do in diplomacy. You know, and at some level you can, but not when it comes to issues that are very important. And so, you know, I think this is all going to come to a head at some point. And yes, and somebody's going to have to give up on some things. That agree to disagree is not going to last for a long time. And also, you know, Bennett goes around the world and he talks about this government and how it's a unity government and it's fighting against the polarization that is plaguing politics all over the world, etc. And it is a really nice thing to say. But
that gives you credit just for a bit. Though.
Exactly.
Right.
And I think that Bennett thinks he's going to get more credit from that than he actually will, because I think that the credit is already running out. I think that, you know, we're hearing more from the EU and member states as well.
Right. The new kid on the block will only last for a certain period of time. And he got some grace, right, from the Biden administration, also from the Europeans, where they were keeping their criticism of settlement stuff and all of that activity tame for a period, but that's not going to last forever. And I think we're starting to see that crumble. The question is, though, is there something within the government that would bring it to implode inside, right? You know, we saw about the Evyatar illegal outpost where there had been people that moved there. The government got them to leave on the condition that they would build a yeshiva there. Omer Bar-Lev, who's the public security minister from Labor, has said that he would object to that happening. So we're already starting to see some problems even within the coalition.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're used to coalitions usually, or cabinets usually passing things by relative consensus. And if one or two ministers oppose, like, that's a news story. I think this government is going to end up passing a lot of things without consensus in the cabinet. Legally in Israel, if you're a member of the cabinet, you're considered responsible for what it decides, whether you voted for or against whatever it decides. But, you know, politically, I think the people in Labor and Meretz will be able to say, oh, well, we tried, we voted against it, but it still passed. Will that be able to hold over time? I'm not so sure. But I think, you know, there's just a little example from this week, and it's a very different issue from settlements, but still, Justice Minister Gideon Saar nominated former Justice Minister Meir Shitrit,
right,
to be a member of the advisory panel to pick the next attorney general. Now, when Shitrit ran for president 7 years ago, there were reports in the news that he had sexually harassed his cleaning lady.
And it paid her off.
And then paid her off. And he unequivocally denies it. And there wasn't even, like, there was, like, a preliminary look into it by the police, and they found that there was no story there, that there was nothing, there was no evidence, and it was dropped. It was summarily dropped. And so Gideon Saar said, he has no record, there's nothing legal against him, and I'm not going to, you know, indict people, or, metaphorically indict people over hearsay. Right. You know, this is someone who's qualified to be on this committee.
He's a former justice minister.
Right. And, you know, was one of the most, I mean, he was in the Knesset for, like, I think close to 40 years. So someone who really understands what's going on. And the members of Labor and Meretz and a couple, and one minister from Yesh Atid as well, they all voted against it because they felt like, you know, hashtag believe all women.
Is that what they actually tweeted?
No.
Oh, that's your way of describing it. Got it.
Yes. Okay. But they didn't actually, I don't think any of them actually tweeted it, but somebody leaked it for the cabinet meeting, mm-hmm, that they all voted against it.
But the point is that this is another point of friction. Right?
The point is another point of friction. The point is that Saar got what he wanted. He got Meir Shitrit on this committee, but several people made a point of voting against it and made sure that the media knew about, mm-hmm, it. So I think that's going to be a pattern.
Look, I think that there's a chance that this government does last, right? If they keep their eye on the ball, which is to people of Israel and improving their quality of life. But we know that politics tend to take over and to become more powerful than what they're supposed to be focused on. And therefore, it'll be interesting. I mean, sometimes, you know, we've seen governments fall at the stupidest things, right, in the past. So, you know, who knows what could occur in the future. And whether Bennett and Lapid can keep people in line and keep it together. I think the consulate is one example of something that if Israel were to have to give its approval to the Americans to open the consulate and it would happen, you would see Yamina, which is a party already of people, that's Bennett's party, is so not together, right? So a total mess. People would bolt over something like the consulate and maybe even New Hope and Gideon Saar's party. So I don't know. So I think that's something that they have to be against also because it pertains to the survival of their coalition. Lahav, also on Iran, we're getting to the countdown. The talks are supposed to renew or resume at the end of the month, right? What is it, November 29th? Yeah. Everyone's getting excited. Vienna again, is that the venue for these
still
talks?
Yeah, still in Vienna. That's still where the Vienna. IAEA is. Mm-hmm.
So. They want to go where Herzl came from, where he, right, where he exactly. had these visions of the state of Israel and the idea of Jewish independence. What's the assumption here, right? I mean, Israel clearly, we know they're not happy with the deal or a possible return to it, but we're also not seeing the same aggressive, fierce resistance that we remember from 2014, 2015 when Netanyahu was prime minister.
Yeah, so Lapid, for a long time, looked at the way Netanyahu was behaving with the Iran deal and disagreed with it. Back in 2015, when Netanyahu gave a speech before Congress, and President Obama opposed that speech, Lapid thought it was the wrong way to go about things, even though Lapid himself opposes the Iran deal. And that's an important nuance, because Netanyahu likes to say that Lapid is in favor of the Iran deal. And no, he's not in favor of the Iran deal, he's just not in favor of the way Netanyahu dealt with it. Anyway, Bennett eventually became convinced of Lapid's approach, that going head-to-head with the Americans didn't work for Netanyahu.
The Iran deal eventually right. went through.
The Iran right. deal eventually went through, and that Netanyahu was betting on Trump winning in 2020, basically, so that the maximum pressure sanctions on Iran would continue. But that didn't happen. And now we have to deal with what we have, which is a Biden administration that has promised to rejoin the Iran deal.
By the way, just I'll open parentheses for a moment. One thing that I once heard from Netanyahu people was that, yes, it didn't work in stopping the Iran deal, back what he did in 2015, the famous speech to Congress. But what it did do was it presented him in the eyes of the world, and definitely in front of the Republicans, as the main fighter against the Iran deal, so that when Donald Trump comes into the White House in 2017, wins the elections in 2016, and he looks around, it wasn't Mitch McConnell who fought against the Iran deal, it was Benjamin Netanyahu. And that's what paved the way, maybe, to what Israel, the strategic benefits it got out of the Trump administration, Jerusalem, Abraham Accords, etc.
I agree. I think there were a lot of benefits to Netanyahu's approach. I also think that the Abraham Accords, to some extent, were born out of Netanyahu's approach. Netanyahu talks all the time that, you know, as he was giving his speech in Congress, people from various Middle Eastern countries were contacting his office wanting to talk to him about it. I do think that it definitely bore fruit, you know, during the Trump administration.
Right. It soured ties with the Democrats, but it helped Israel regionally and to some extent.
Right. But Bennett comes into office. Biden is president. Biden wants to return to the Iran deal. And Bennett has to figure out how to deal with this moment.
Right.
And in this moment, he agrees with Lapid that, you know, we have to work with the Americans as much as possible. That being said, they do speak out against the Iran deal often. I mean, we're not like joking about it the way we did with Netanyahu, where like it's like practically a drinking game. Like every time he says Iran, nuclear, whatever. But Iran is in
a— can you imagine that every time Bibi would say Iran, we would have to have a shot of whiskey?
Right, exactly.
Whole country would be drunk all day.
Yeah, I would sometimes like joke on Twitter. I would do like a count. How many times did Netanyahu mention Iran? But Bennett also does mention Iran every day. Every leader he meets with, it comes up.
Also,
it's still important.
You were with him at the climate conference in Scotland. He was talking about it there with everybody.
Right. He met with Boris Johnson and Emmanuel Macron, who are both, you know,
gas emissions versus nuclear proliferation. I think nuclear proliferation took over in his conversations.
Yeah, of course. Right. And so, you know, Bennett is still making Israel's case, but he's trying to make it in a more diplomatic way. And I think that he wants to continue to partner with the U.S. on Israel's security, and including defending Israel from Iran as much as possible. Now, I also think that these talks, you know, Iran is not actually indicating that they really want to go back to the deal. They're indicating the opposite. They're saying that the talks will only work if the U.S. lifts all sanctions. Right. The talks will only work if Biden gives a guarantee that the U.S. won't leave. The U.S. does not have Biden does not have the political ability to do either of those things. When it comes to sanctions, a lot of the sanctions are human rights and ties to terrorism, and they're not necessarily about the nuclear thing. Like, even if the Trump administration was the one who put those sanctions on various Iranians, they're still human rights violators. Congress isn't going to want to overturn those. And then when it comes to giving guarantees, Biden can only give guarantees for his administration. Constitutionally, he cannot hold back another president from making his own decisions about it, especially because it's not a treaty that's being ratified by Congress. And Iran knows that. You know, they're not new
to
this.
That could be just a stalling tactic on their part.
But it's been, I mean, there's been more stalling than talks, right? Negotiations took place from April to June. We're now in November. It's going to be 2 days before December when they come back to talks.
Yeah, but I think practically speaking, and, you know, we'll obviously be following this very closely, and you'll be writing about it, and everyone can follow what you're writing and our coverage. But it's not as if Israel has to attack tomorrow anyhow, right? In other words, the time is not, it's not a fast countdown right now. It's not moving in a good direction. But if there is going to be a deal, even in 6 months from now, that's something that would bind Israel, and it would prevent Israel from being able to take action, I think, for a period of time, as long as the Iranians stay in the deal.
You literally wrote the book on this. So what is the last time to attack, right?
Well, I think the question, look, if you look at when Israel attacked Iraq and the Osirak reactor, when Israel attacked the Al-Kibar reactor in Syria, it was both at the point where the reactor was about to go hot, right? In other words, there would be a dispersion of radioactive material, and that would be something that would cause potential devastation. That was definitely the case in Syria. It was very close to the Euphrates River, and Israel feared that if it waited longer, and once they installed the fuel rods and there was actually nuclear material in there, that could be very problematic. So Israel wanted to attack before then, but here we're not at that stage. In other words, they're not. We don't have that problem. We have other problems. They have scattered facilities, some of them buried deep underground.
And that brings us back to the budget, because there have been reports that Israel wants to buy new advanced bunker buster bombs for the U.S.
Right. And we ran a story this week by Annie Ehrenheim, our military correspondent, that in this after passing the budget, one of the IDF's big plans is to get more firepower, more satellite-guided munitions, more bunker busters to be able to take deal not just with Iran, but with all of the different enemies that it faces. Right. So we'll be on top of the story. We'll be talking about this, I'm sure, on our podcast in the weeks ahead, especially as we get closer to the Iran talks and as they begin. This week on the podcast, though, we have two great interviews. One of them is with Jonathan Chanzer, who is the senior vice president, I think I got that title right, for the Foundation of the Defense of Democracies, FDD, a really great think tank in Washington, D.C. We spoke to him about his new book called Gaza Conflict 2021, Hamas, Israel, and 11 Days of War, which refers, he kind of wrote very quickly, he tells us in the podcast, about what happened back in May and what Israel called Operation Guardian of Walls. I don't remember some name like that. And then we also spoke with Rabbi Ari Lam, who is the CEO of B'nai Tzion. Interesting conversation. Lahav and Ari are very, as you'll tell, much cooler than I am. They know all these like hip hop rappers. I don't know any of these guys, but an interesting conversation about faith, belief, religiosity in America today and around the world, and bringing young people to religion. Right, which is something that Rabbi Lam focuses on. So here we go. It's great to be joined by Dr. Jonathan Chanzer. He's the Senior Vice President for Research at the FDD, the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Oversees work of the organization's experts, scholars, and is a great speaker on everything that has to do with terrorism in Israel. But we're talking to Jonathan because he came out with really a fantastic book called The Gaza Conflict 2021, Hamas, Israel, and 11 Days of War. And Jonathan, you wrote this book in like, I think probably record time, where this is in reference to what in Israel is called by the terrible name Guardian of the Walls, which was the last flare up between Israel and Hamas in May of this year. And what I found interesting about your book was not only obviously the speed of how quickly you got it out and the depth that it presents, but also your own personal kind of relationship with Gaza, which you tell in a bit there of, you know, some of the first times that you actually had gone there and how, of course, nowadays you can't really go in there. But why don't you just tell us briefly, you know, what that was like as someone who had been to Gaza many years ago, had seen what Gaza once upon a time was, and really what it's turned into in recent years.
Sure. Thank you, Yaakov. And thank you, Lahav. I really appreciate the opportunity. I wrote about in the beginning of the book that I visited Gaza when I was a graduate student at the Hebrew University. That was back in 1998. I had a sense even back then that Gaza was in for it. You know, you could really see the influence of Hamas everywhere. Of course, several years later, Hamas overran the country, or the territory rather, and kind of created its own little mini country within. It is the sovereign there, and it's gotten worse over time in terms of the influence of this Iran-backed terrorist organization. And, you know, the misery, I think, is something that no one can deny. But I think it's interesting that over time, Israel's been blamed for the misery of the Gazans, as opposed to Iran or Hamas itself. And it's also been remarkable to me, as I've watched now four different Gaza conflicts erupt, at how poorly they're covered, how poorly understood this territory is among Western journalists in particular. And this most recent round of conflict, I followed the conflict a lot more carefully than I had some of the previous ones, and not because I was more interested, not because this was a particularly fascinating round of violence, but Really, it was by virtue of the technology. I was able to watch it in real time from my home here in suburban Washington, D.C. I could watch Israeli TV. I could watch Arabic TV. I was even able to watch Palestinian TV. And the disconnect between what we saw on the ground and what was being reported here in the U.S. was really jarring to me. So with all of that experience and my own experiences there, having visited Gaza, I just felt like the time was right for a book. And so I jammed this one out pretty quickly with the idea and the hope that it would be the first one on the market and hopefully start a discussion about the way that this particular conflict was covered, but also the previous ones as well.
Well, we in Israel are no stranger to being misrepresented in the press. Right now, there's a hashtag going viral on Twitter, hashtag sad, sad Israel, because of this New York Times article where everyone complains about how bad their life is in Israel. but back to the topic of your book, what do you think was the biggest sort of misconception that was being reported at the time?
Well, it's hard to point to one because there were so many, but there are a couple that I would point out that I think are pretty obvious. The first one was the cause of the war. Heading into the war, I think most outlets here in the United States were pointing to a real estate dispute in the East Jerusalem neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, as if a real estate dispute is the cause of war. Last I checked, it's the person who fires bullets or rockets that start a war, not a legal proceeding. And really, if you wanted to look at maybe the motivation of Hamas for launching this war, you'd probably be better served by looking at what happened with the Palestinian political system and how it had a complete breakdown in April. There had been elections planned. They were canceled. Hamas was furious, and Hamas was looking to win back the hearts and minds of the Palestinian political scene. And one way that it has done that consistently over the years is by waging war against Israel. That's a far easier explanation for me to swallow than the idea that a real estate dispute set this whole thing off. But really, nothing set it off other than Hamas, which was watching what was happening in Jerusalem and decided to fire rockets from 50 miles away to make themselves part of the story. So I think that was number one for me, and that one drove me a little crazy. But there were two others that I thought were fascinating. I think an obvious one to point to was the Metro debacle. If you recall, the IDF yes. tweeted that it was putting boots on the ground in the Gaza Strip. The Western outlets ran the story sight unseen. The Israeli outlets did not. I mean, I actually, when I saw those tweets, I went into my home, I turned on the TV, Channel 11, the reporter on the border was saying, can't report this. My sources are not telling me. And by the way, I don't see anything going on behind me. I turned it to Channel 13, same thing, right? Can't report this. Don't know why the West is. This is odd. So the Western reporters run with it. The Israeli military begins to bomb the metro tunnel system that Hamas had created. It's a surprise attack. It looked like an info op, an information operation. The Israelis still deny that that's what happened. But even if it was an info op, I would say that the Israeli media did not fall for it. Only the American media did. And I think that really points to a disconnect between those that truly follow this space and follow it well and those that don't. And I think the Western press has a lot to learn from the Israeli press when they follow these conflicts. The last one that I'll just note is the Jala Tower, the building that Israel destroyed.
The building with the AP Bureau and the Al Jazeera Bureau.
Correct. And the thing that happened at the time was that, people were just piling on the Israelis saying that they were trying to disrupt the media coverage of the war, as if to say Israel's, losing the battle for hearts and minds and therefore had to bomb the building that housed AP and Al Jazeera. And of course, what we've learned since then is that there was some kind of signals intelligence office that Hamas was running, and the goal was to disrupt or to jam Iron Dome. And the Israelis have apparently given proof of that to the United States, satisfied the Biden administration, but it still took a beating from the press throughout. And then, just one postscript to that story was, Al Jazeera was based there. Al Jazeera is funded by the Qataris. It's owned by the Qataris, who happen to be the sponsors of Hamas in the Gaza Strip. Other than Iran, they're probably number two. And Al Jazeera has been at the center of a number of ugly war stories where they happen to be right in the middle, the thick of it, with groups like Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and others around the world, where they actually were playing something of a role in these conflicts. And that wasn't noted either. So there was a lot to point to in terms of poor coverage.
Israel has had, as you mentioned, four operations in recent years since Gaza. It depends, obviously, how you count things. But since Israel pulled out of Gaza in 2005, right, there was there've been a number of operations, and each one was different in one way or the other. You know, some included a ground offensive, some were just from the air, right? That was a pillar of defense. I think back in 2012 was just by the air. Cast-Lead in 2008-09 was on the ground and on the air. Protective Edge started in the air, also then included a limited ground operation in 2014, and this was just an aerial operation. But what I found to be very interesting during this operation was in May, was that, if I'm not mistaken, almost solely all of the weapons and bombs that Israel dropped, and it struck about 1,500 targets during these 12 days of fighting in Gaza, were precision-guided munitions, right? So these were like JDAMs and smart bombs and GPS satellite-guided weapons, no stupid weapons. Everything knew where it was going to minimize, obviously, collateral damage and hit just the targets. And if you look even at the death toll, and I don't want to minimize the tragedy of a loss of life, but Israel speaks of how out of the 250 or 60, however many people, you know, depending which count you go with, the vast majority were terrorists or militants associated and affiliated with terrorist organizations, Hamas and mostly Islamic Jihad. And I'm curious, you know, the world obviously ignores that, right? When you look at this operation, what were the differences that you saw in the way Israel operated this time around as opposed to previous times?
Yeah, look, it's a good question. And I think, first of all, the care that Israel took, the sheer amount of ordnance that was fired into the Gaza Strip and the way that Israel took great pains to avoid those civilian casualties, I think is notable here, but it's rather similar to what we've seen in the past. I would actually say that there was more continuity in this conflict than change. The Israelis were very prepared for this conflict, as they were in conflicts past. They had target banks that they had been collecting, where the Shin Bet and the IDF work together and get legal approval in advance for targets that they know they will have to hit in the next round. We've seen that repeatedly. It happened again. The Israelis were prepared for the surprise attack in the metro tunnel system, and they were able to neutralize it. They were also aware through, I guess, you know, probably human intelligence, that there were UAVs, aerial UAVs, as well as underwater UAVs that were going to be deployed. The Israelis were prepared for that as well. I mean, I think that the broader point here is that Hamas knows going into each round of conflict that it is going to lose, that it is going to be facing a much more powerful foe, and that the likelihood of victory is near zero. And yet they launch it anyway. The Israelis do everything they can to avoid collateral damage. They try to head off a lot of the more dangerous attacks before they happen. They neutralize 80 or 90% of the rockets that are fired out of Gaza into Israel through Iron Dome. Some get through, most don't. And, you know, tensions run high. But at the end of the day, everyone knows how this thing is going to end. And that is that Israel doesn't change any of its policies significantly. Hamas remains where it is. And they try to extract a few more concessions out of the Qataris in particular, maybe the Egyptians, but the Israelis remain unchanged. And quite frankly, the Israelis can't do much. They can't offer much more to Hamas, as long as it is dedicated to Israel's destruction and continues to stockpile weapons to that end. So a lot of this was just sadly predictable. And it does raise the question of who's, at some point, is somebody going to step in and say, look, we got to bring an end to this. That this is just, I mean, it's Groundhog's Day. Right. You know, you see this is now the fourth Gaza war. There will be a fifth. There probably will be a sixth at some point. How do you bring an end to this? And I don't know the answer.
Well, it doesn't seem like anybody knows the answer, sadly. I mean, it seems like this government You know, they don't want to send suitcases of cash anymore, but they're basically sending money into Gaza in other ways. Do you think that it's a different, do you think it makes a difference? You think that that's better that they're sending, it's like these ATM cards to needy families, and Egypt is negotiating, trying to negotiate a long-term ceasefire, although the short-term has lasted, I guess, for about 6 months now. You know, what do you think about the way things sort of ended this time?
Yeah, look, they ended in a way where Israel could say that it emerged victorious and that it destroyed a lot of infrastructure. Hamas will say that it emerged victorious because it, quite frankly, it wasn't destroyed. But the situation remains tenuous at best. I think the credit card process might be better, if only because you'll be able to actually track how the money is spent. When the money came in with cash, suitcases full of Qatari cash, that could be very easily diverted for Hamas to be able to, finance some of its own operations. And so I do think that the credit card thing might be better. I'll put a big asterisk next to that because I just don't know how it'll all work out. The Egyptian role in this was interesting. The Egyptians, I think, did not get enough credit for working the ceasefire from the moment that tensions began to erupt in Israel and on the Gaza Strip. They did a terrific job in really tenaciously chasing that ceasefire. I don't think they got enough attention or credit from the Biden administration. They kind of handed the victory to Biden, who briefly mentioned Egypt as a partner, when it was really the Egyptians that did it all along. The real question that I have now is whether Egypt can try to get to a longer term agreement. And I don't think that is something that they will be able to do, if I'm going to be honest. Because again, you got to remember, Hamas exists to destroy Israel. Their primary patrons, Iran in particular, seek the destruction of Israel. Their secondary patrons, like Qatar and Turkey, have it out for Israel as well. They're not as aggressive as Iran, but they certainly are looking to cause headaches within Israel wherever they can. And so I just don't see who the positive actors are. If we saw Egypt take more of an active role, for example, in the governance of the Gaza Strip, or even countries that are, you know, from the Abraham Accords, like the UAE, then we might see something different. But at least for now, I see the same actors propping up Hamas. I see the same leaders from within Hamas. That doesn't really offer a whole lot of change.
You know, just tying into what you said in the beginning, people, when they were talking about Sheikh Jarrah, as the excuse of why this round of violence happened, as you just mentioned, they don't need an excuse, right? They are bent on destroying Israel, right? So, you know, Sheikh Jarrah is the convenient excuse today, but they don't need an excuse to try to do what they say they actively want to do. But I'm curious, as I was reading through the book, And really, it's a great read for people who are looking for a comprehensive history of this conflict that's really been going on primarily in a very, I would say, kind of in your face way over the last 15, 16 years, definitely since Israel pulled out of Gaza, with these rounds of violence that people now are remembering because of the last round in May. But you have dinner with Eliezer Toledano, who is the commander of the Southern Command. And you meet with some other officials, but him you actually meet with, and you mention him by name, and you even quote some things that he said, which I found to be interesting, as opposed to some of these unnamed defense officials who you met with. But you then, you talk about kind of, so what's next, right? You know, is it a three-state solution? Is it a peace process that's going to solve a peace process between Israel and the Palestinians and the West Bank that would somehow solve the problem also of Gaza? And I'm curious also, and you speak about obviously trying to deal with Tehran and temping down Iran's involvement there as a way to cut off maybe aid and their support and get Hamas to possibly moderate. But what I wanted to know also is, A, what is the solution in your view, after having studied it so well and deeply? But also, is there an economic element here? Because a lot of people talk about, if we let in more Palestinians to work in Israel, if we throw some money their way, if we build infrastructure, ports, power plants, industrial zones, that could make a difference. Right now, they don't have assets. Maybe this would moderate them. What are your thoughts on those things?
So, all good questions. I will say that probably the most interesting thing that Toledano said in that dinner was that Gaza was a lost district, that it's not something that Israel controls or wants. It's not something that the Palestinian Authority controls, even if it wants. It's not something that Egypt can control, and it certainly doesn't want. So in other words, all of the regional actors don't know what to do with this particular territory, and it's festered since Hamas took control in 2007 in a brutal civil war, by the way, that few people remember was the result of Hamas aggression with Iranian assistance. And so it's been this way since at least then. Now, in terms of how you could try to effect change, I have to say I kept coming back to the sponsors of Hamas in particular. Iran, I mean, I go back to the days of the Oslo process, beginning in the 1990s, even the late 1980s after the Intifada, the first Intifada broke out, that Iran has been a consistent financial sponsor for Hamas. It has consistently provided the weapons that Hamas uses, whether it's the suicide bombings or the rockets. They're providing a lot of the training of the commandos that have fought Israel in the tunnels beneath the Gaza Strip. You know, all roads point back to Tehran. And, you know, one of the things that I looked at is, you know, this question that has come up now about whether the United States and Iran enter back into, the 2015 JCPOA, the nuclear agreement. And I warn in the book, and I'll warn here, that if the U.S. does that, and if the U.S. does provide those billions of dollars in sanctions relief to the Iranians, what we will effectively be doing here in Washington is funding both sides of the next round of this conflict, right? That we already provide assistance to the Israelis. There have been a few members of Congress that don't want to do that, but it's still something that Congress will do for the foreseeable future. But then if we provide Iran with sanctions relief, we're going to be giving the patron of Hamas billions of dollars, and we know that that money will trickle down to Gaza. And that is something that we should be avoiding at all costs. If what we're trying to do is to prevent these kinds of conflicts from erupting again and from destabilizing the Middle East, we cannot be financing the regime in Iran. You start to deprive them of that cash and you bankrupt them for causing the terrorism that we see all around the world. I actually think you can begin to see some change within Hamas. But right now they have no motivation to do that because Iran continues to be their patron.
So as we're speaking, actually, the news broke that Iran and the EU announced that talks in Vienna are going to resume on November 29th. And aside from ruining Thanksgiving weekend for Rob Malley and his team, what do you think? Sorry to spring breaking news on you, but what do you think? Where do you think those talks are going to go?
Well, we have, you know, you probably, if you follow FTD, you know that we've got a really great team of Iran folks that track this stuff. And the concern...
You have sanctions, right? The Iran running...
They sanctioned
FTD. Sanctions against you, right?
They did. Yeah. They identified us as terrorists for writing things that they don't like.
So we shouldn't visit Tehran with you anytime soon.
No, probably not. You probably shouldn't also visit the West Bank or Istanbul with me either. I think the concern that we're hearing from our Iran folks is that there's going to be what Malley and company are calling less for less, a more modest agreement that will essentially enshrine Iran's illicit gains on the nuclear front and allow them to keep them in some shape or form. Without addressing a lot of the other core issues, the more important issues, the longer term issues. We should be trying to extract more from them, a more comprehensive agreement, one that literally shuts down every pathway to a nuclear weapon. That's not what the original deal did. It's unfortunately, it doesn't look like it's what the next deal will do either. But if they're doing it right, they would shut it all down, right? They would make sure that every component of the nuclear program has been exposed, every pathway toward developing a nuke, whether it's advanced centrifuges, whether it's R&D, all the things that should have been addressed the last time around should be now. We're just not seeing a will on the part of the Biden administration, and certainly not from Rob Malley right now in addressing those core issues.
Well, Jonathan, it was great to have you on the Jerusalem Post podcast. We appreciate your time. And to our listeners, check out his book. It's called Gaza Conflict 2021. It's about not only the recent war that was fought there in May of this year, but also about the history of Gaza, the rounds of violence that have taken place over the years. Jonathan Schanzer from FDD, great to have you.
Thank you very much.
Our latest guest is Rabbi Ari Lam, the CEO of B'nai Tzion, an organization that's over a century old, supporting Israel-related causes, and Ari will get into it some more, and also the host of the Good Faith Effort podcast, which has brought on some really fascinating guests to talk about ideas in the weekly Torah portion. So thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
So could you tell us a little bit about B'nai Tzion?
Sure. It's an incredible organization. As you said, it's, I think now it's, we're approaching our 114th birthday. And it's for a very long time, needless to say, supported really ambitious projects, supporting Jewish life and life in the land of Israel, life in the state of Israel, once that became a thing. And it's always been focused on, visionary things that would build infrastructure for tomorrow, as opposed to just addressing problems that are here today or yesterday. So, you know, at an early stage, we gave the early gift that established Magen David Adom. This is back in the 20s. We gave the gift that opened up Bezalel College, which is the oldest institution for higher education in the state of Israel, because we looked down the line and said, listen, if there's going to be a state, there needs to be medical infrastructure and there needs to be higher education. We were instrumental in founding the city of Afula, actually. And, you know, you kind of look across the country and B'nai Tzion's impact is felt. It's pretty amazing. And now the question is, what are kind of the new frontiers? So I think about it by analogy to, the old, you know, like, the old West, right? So at a certain point, America, sees its next challenge as sort of expanding throughout its borders, right? So it's kind of the United States begins on the Atlantic coast and then it pushes across the Pacific coast. But at a certain point, there's no more place left to expand. And so the question becomes, what's the next frontier? So one way to think about it is, instead of going horizontally, you go vertically, you go into space. That was kind of the 1960s. But another way to think about it is to think about borders in a different way. And today I think people think about digital borders. And so that's kind of a similar way in which we think about how B'nai Tzion can play a role in advancing the interests of the Jewish people and the state of Israel. You know, Israel now is essentially more or less has the shape that it's going to take, we hope, you know, for the next very long time. You know, we don't expect Israel to expand into, like, you know, Russia or Japan, you know. So sure. Israel is more or less what it's going to be, territorially speaking, give or take, obviously, some, you know, whatever geopolitical issues there are. But the question is, what's next? And the way we think about it is that what's next is not territorial boundaries, but cultural boundaries. And in particular, we're really, really focused on pop culture, because after militaries and governments, it's the most powerful force on the planet. And the question is, what role do or should great Jewish ideas, values, great stories rooted in the land of Israel and in our tradition, what role should those stories play in lifting people up on a daily basis and infusing people's daily lives? So that's our next target.
So this is great, because when you were at the Jerusalem Post conference last month, I remember, and maybe you'll remember, I don't remember the context in which you said this, but you were talking about Kendrick Lamar. And I thought to myself, how many people at the Jerusalem Post conference even know who Kendrick Lamar is, you know? But you managed to, like, bring it all together with, like, Jewish ideas and civilizational ideas. So maybe tell us a little bit about how you bring pop culture into things.
Sure. Hey, before you answer that question, also tell us, the ignorant people on the podcast, who is Kendrick Lamar? I think he's a rapper, right? But, you know,
he's a rapper, and he won a Pulitzer Prize for his rap.
Not all of us are as cool as Lahav, who know who all these rappers are. So please.
Well, Lahav is one of the coolest people I know. So I hear what you're saying. Fair point. There's nothing that brings me more joy than sitting in a room full of capital, you know, V, very serious people, and talking about Snoop Dogg. So that was definitely a fun day. The basic thesis of what we're doing is saying, now is perhaps the most incredible moment since the invention of mass media for the promulgation of great, not promulgation, it's the wrong word, for like telling incredible stories that are rooted in Jewish ideas, Jewish values and faith ideas. And usually when I tell people that, they look at me like I'm crazy, because after all, isn't, you know, Hollywood and the entertainment industry just this sort of like den of hedonistic pleasure and skepticism and cynicism? And the answer is it might be, but here's how I would tell the story. You think back to, you know, and this was sort of where I started going at the Jerusalem Post conference, but you think back to kind of when I was growing up, kind of late 80s, early 90s, what was the great music that I love to listen to? And this was, needless to say, this was before I got my rabbinical degree, but even after I got my smicha, this is still stuff I appreciate. You think about who were the biggest music superstars on the entire planet. They all came from a little town in California called Compton. So you're talking Eazy-E, Snoop Dogg, Dr. Dre, Ice-T, like these guys who were the biggest names in music, international superstars, all came from this one town. And although I love their music and appreciate it, and I think it served an important documentary purpose, it was widely maligned, but also misunderstood. One thing you could definitely say for it is that it was sort of very self-focused and materialistic. Now, you fast forward 30 years to today, and the biggest music superstars on the planet still come from this one town in California, from Compton. But today, it's people like Kendrick Lamar, it's people like Vince Staples. I'm going to throw a lot of names that you might not be familiar with, but these are the biggest superstars on the planet. You go to Chicago, it's Kanye West, maybe a more familiar name, it's Chance the Rapper. Outside of hip-hop, you go to Justin Bieber, Tori Kelly, Selena Gomez, Carrie Underwood. What all of these people have in common is that they are massive international A-list superstars, and they are proud of their faith. They are loud about their engagement with scripture and the Bible. They go to church, they talk about it in public, and they see this as something that they use to narrate their life. Like, this is the story of who they are. And what's remarkable, I mean, just take, I'll just, you know, Yaakov, to address your question, who is Kendrick Lamar? I mean, Kendrick Lamar is the best rapper on the planet. And if you go through his last, you know, no shots at anybody else, but he's very good. If you go through his last couple of albums, you will find on every single track multiple references to the Bible, to verses from the Bible, to scripture, to God, to church, to angels and demons. And it's very much filtered through his experience in and growth in the Black church in America, which is an incredibly powerful and, you know, culturally powerful and emotionally and spiritually powerful institution. But this is something that was kind of like unimaginable, I think, to mass culture like 30 years ago, but today it's de rigueur. And so the question is, well, not the question, the reality is that we're at a moment in history, like I said, for the first time since the invention of mass media in like the early 1900s, where faith and culture are actually converging.
But let me ask you, Rabbi, it comes at a time, and that's very, it's actually very interesting. And we probably all of us saw that tweet or that little video of Kanye West talking about the Jewish kibbutz, right, where he was trying to
explain. I just saw this yesterday.
My mom separated me for the opportunity of more money when we don't have that love, like a kibbutz. We need Christian kibbutz. We can have communities, be as close.
Kibbutz?
Kibbutz, like Jewish people have this type of circular community.
Like a community center?
No, it's like where they live and where we need to live, where the grandparents can take care of the kids. It's better to have a grandparent taking care of the kids than a nanny taking care of hired love.
But no question that these artists are incorporating religion in a greater way than in the past. But it comes at a time where we saw, for example, this Gallup poll a few months ago. And I know that you wrote about this in the Wall Street Journal, of how the, I think it was, what, less than 50% of Americans belong today to a religious community, whether it's a church or a synagogue or anything else, and lowest number since the 30s. So isn't that kind of something of a conundrum? Like, on the one hand, you're seeing these famous artists who everyone is following have millions upon millions and millions of followers on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and what have you. But on the other hand, Americans aren't going in that religious direction.
The poll that you're referencing is from Gallup, and I remember when it came out. What it found was that attendance at brick-and-mortar houses of worship had dipped to the lowest point in the history of the United States since this stat has been measured, you know, officially measured. So, you know, since the 30s, let's say. And I remember when it came out, all of the various, you know, clergy and pastoral WhatsApp groups that I'm a part of were blowing up, and people are panicking and doom and gloom and a lot of anger and upset and discomfort and anxiety. And I remember thinking to myself, well, I mean, not that this is a very sophisticated reaction, but duh, you know, and I, as you said, I wrote about this in the Wall Street Journal. What Pew had found actually shortly before that study came out is that young people, young millennials, Gen Z, and some even younger cohorts, however they're subdividing them these days, are more likely to describe themselves as seeking spirituality, meaning, purpose, in faith than any other cohort in the last several generations. And if these studies sound like they should be in tension, it's only if you're not paying attention, because what happens is that young people, I think the reason why faith is making such a comeback, and in the particular fashion that it is among young people, is that there's this widespread feeling that the older generation has kind of failed. And it's failed particularly in denuding the public square of any sense of transcendence, meaning, purpose. And so what you get is kind of like a class of like older parents where and grandparents who themselves kind of, you know, abandoned any sense of community. And in some ways, the communities failed them as well. I don't want to put the blame just on people, and decided that, you know, meaning can best be found in individual excellence and in, you know, and in personal striving. And the ethos, the overriding ethos in society was be yourself. Right. Remember I remember when the U.S. military started putting out commercials where it was like an army of one. Right. And it was this, it was trying to like take this big collective endeavor and make it sound really individualistic. And, you know, what people since Rousseau have found is that, well, if you want to be yourself, that's great, but you got to do it by yourself. And it's not a mistake that in the last 10 to 15 years, both in the US, in Europe, and in many places across what we would typically call the West, loneliness has been on the rise. People are miserable, living by themselves, living apart from family. And it's brought us nothing but pain and suffering.
I think, you know, it's interesting you're talking about like young people being disappointed at the like bowling alone phenomenon, quote unquote. But, you know, I last week I was at the International Climate Conference in Glasgow. And so I've been reading a ton about that topic, you know, before and after it. And there's this other phenomenon among young people, especially when it comes to climate, where they feel like the world is going to hell and we may as well just, like, people don't want to have children anymore. They're not so interested in families, and there's like a lot of hopelessness going on. So I feel like, I don't know,
I think it
contrasts with some of what you're saying. Yeah.
Well, I think it's an important part of the story because that you're right. There's like a broad feeling. I think there's a broad background for younger generations of feeling helpless, feeling disempowered. And you could argue it's in their imaginations, or maybe it's not real, or maybe the threats to their future are not as dire as they believe. But whatever the case may be, I think there's a feeling of being adrift. Now, there are a couple different ways you could react to that. One way you could react to it is by embracing all sorts of other replacements for religion. Religion was the traditional, way to stave off meaninglessness or to infuse meaningfulness into your life. And in the absence of religion, you can imagine people embracing all sorts of alternatives to that, whether it be, you know, climate activism or antinatalism or what have you. But it's not a surprise that many young people are actually choosing spirituality, choosing religion. The only difference is that they're not doing it in the same place where their parents told them to go. So they're not going back to the brick and mortar houses of worship. They're going to places and spaces where they feel more in control of the environment and more like they can leave their stamp. So a lot of this, you know, engagement is happening on TikTok, on Instagram, on Snapchat, on Twitter, and so on and so forth, because these are places that feel sort of less captured. And so what we see in this era is just a massive opportunity to tell these kinds of stories and give young people these kinds of outlets and give young talent and young audiences these kinds of outlets to create and tell new stories. And this obviously has
the Jewish story. Where can we make a difference there in telling a different story that can attract a wider audience and maybe tap into those young folks who we all know to an extent are moving farther away from religion, from the state of Israel, from Jewish participation? What can be done to tell them a story that will connect them?
So I think there are two parts to the question, and I want to disentangle them. One question is, what are the benefits or what are the advantages of this kind of storytelling for young people in general? And the second question is, what does this do or what is the effect of this for Jewish participation, for telling stories about Israel and so forth? So on the first question, the answer seems to me actually quite simple. If you look just, let's say, in an American context, so let's just take one of the issues that, according to all the recent polling from Gallup, Pew, and from many other sources, is of the utmost importance to younger generations. And that is addressing questions of race and racial justice. So, you know, you could protest at the particular salience that this issue has in the contemporary American public discourse. And I personally would do that as well. And, you know, academia is kind of like faintly ridiculous nowadays, maybe even probably even more ridiculous than it's already been, which is saying something. But, you know, just talk about what's in, you know, what's by all polling data is interesting to young people. So here's what I would say. In the entire history of the United States of America, not a single example of progress in fighting racism has ever existed without the storytelling of the Bible. Literally, there is no example. You talk about the idea of where universal human dignity, where the idea that all men are created equal come from. It's drawn, as we know, from the writers and thinkers themselves, directly from the idea of the universal divine image in the Bible. You go to Lincoln, you go to Frederick Douglass. They're all advancing their program for racial justice, reconciliation, based on the stories and ideas of the Bible. Frederick Douglass, when the war is over, compares the second American Republic, as it comes to be called, to Noah exiting the ark and rebuilding the world once again. Then you go from there to Martin Luther King Jr. Martin Luther King Jr. is it always cracks me up when people call him Dr. King, because that is what he was. But at the same time, he was Reverend King. This is a person who died with the words of Moses from the book of Deuteronomy hanging on his lips. You go from there to the modern period. You go to Ronald Reagan, Barack Obama, George W. Bush. Every single president who has thought, talk, or acted about racial justice has done so on the basis of the Bible. And this has been true throughout American history. So if whether you're a believer or not, you know, if you grow up in India, so part of what it means to be Indian is to know what the Ramayana says. If you're French, you need to know Voltaire. In America, the great stories and civic texts that we've always relied upon has been the Bible, and particularly the Hebrew Bible. And so if you want to do great storytelling on issues that matter to young people, the best way to do it is to reach for the stories that have inspired this civilization from its inception. And then that brings me to the second question, which is, what does this do for Jewish participation for Israel? Well, I think there are kind of two elements here. One is, I think one of Israel's biggest problems, as most people identify it, is storytelling. Whether you call it Hasbara or something else, but Israel is widely perceived to have challenges in telling its story to a wider audience. I would argue that it's because Israel tries to tell its story as a 70-year story. And, you know, you try to tell the story of modern Israel being founded and then persevering and so on and so forth. The problem with that 70-year framework is that if you tell the story of Israel as a 70-year story, then it's almost inescapable that Israel is the bad guy today. I mean, it's inescapable, not because it's morally true, but because narratively, that's just how it shakes out. Israel ends up being the big villain in the contemporary story. And there's really no way to change that if you insist on telling Israel's story as a 70-year story. It seems to me, and by the way, that gets even worse when you try to go out and do, you know, hasbara or storytelling in that fashion. What I mean by that is that nobody wants to hear stories about Israel outside of the Jewish community and even inside the Jewish community. Like, no one wants to hear stories about Israel, not because Israel is uniquely bad, but because no one wants to hear stories about some random foreign country out in the middle of nowhere at all. Just like no one in America or England or France or India, whatever, is looking for stories about the Czech Republic. No, you know, no offense, but they're not looking for stories about Israel either. So the challenge that Israel faces is that Israel then has to go out and convince people that they should want to hear some story, you know, whether it's an action film or drama or something about a startup, that they want to hear a story about some random country that's smaller than New Jersey. The way to change that is to tell Israel's story in 3,000 year increments and say, actually, this is a story about the art, about faith, about the history of ideas, about the origins of the West. This is where all of our greatest, most important moral instincts come from. This is the place where they all originated. This is the place where your story, if you value those things, begins. Now, once you frame it that way, I mean, audiences in the hundreds of millions, if not billions, across the world are actively looking for great and better storytelling about faith. I mean, you just look at numbers across any measure of engagement, people are looking for those stories. And so if you present Israel in that framework, then all of a sudden, you don't have to sell people in a way that makes them alert to propaganda or in a way that makes them feel like they're being propagandized. All of a sudden, people want those stories. Like, people want stories about faith and faith engagement. So if people were to lean into great faith storytelling, having nothing to do with Israel at all, like, if people were to lean into that, if storytelling driven by and around faith were to become something normal, something good, and something recognized, Israel all of a sudden has a very natural way to tell its stories. Because the beautiful thing, the best thing about the land of Israel is that you actually don't really need to sell on its behalf. Like, Israel is great at selling itself if you give people the right framework. So that's kind of how I think about these things.
Interesting.
So I have one more, just on a different, well, maybe not a different topic, but I wanted to talk to you about your podcast a little more. One of my favorite episodes, other than the ones that I was on, of course, is when you interviewed Enes Kanter. Thank you. Also, when you interviewed Enes Kanter, the basketball player on the Boston Celtics, and he's such an interesting person. I mean, he's kind of, I guess, sort of maybe he's not a refugee because he came to America to play basketball, but he can't really return to Turkey, his home country, because of his faith, because he follows this like Muslim leader, Gulen, who is opposed to Erdogan. And just to connect to the news, he's now become super outspoken against China, which in the NBA is a big no-no because they have a lot of business in China. And I guess just I think that he's just a really like courageous person. And I just wanted to hear sort of what that was like and what did you sort of learn from having him on the show?
The first thing that we connected about was, I believe I had him on, I can't remember which fast day it was after, but I had him on shortly after both a Jewish fast day and I think in the middle of Ramadan. And the first thing that we bonded over was I said to him, I said, you know, when I tell, you know, my colleagues and friends who are Christian that I just had a fast day yesterday, like, what do you think is the first question they give me? What's the first question you think they ask me? And Enes, without batting an eyelash, oh, they want to know, you can't even drink water? I'm like, exactly.
Yes, that's so true.
Exactly. No, like, Jews and Muslims, like, do real fasting. So, you know, we actually, another fun story about him is that when we, Enes is like a intellectually incredibly curious person and a voracious reader. And I remember when I was preparing for that interview with him, I started reading a lot of the stuff that that Fethullah Gulen puts out, and a lot of his religious writings and ideological writings, and he's very focused on the sanctity of knowledge and the importance of integrating faith and science and so forth. And it was just a lot of stuff that was very similar to the writings that I cherish from my grandfather and teacher, Rabbi Norman Lamb of blessed memory, who was the president of Yeshiva University for many years. And his probably best known book, my grandfather, was a book called Torah Umada. Torah Umada is sort of that integration of religious knowledge and secular knowledge. And so when I went out to lunch with Ennis, I brought him a copy of Torah Umada. And he actually sat there at the table, like in total silence for like 10 minutes reading a chapter. And then took pictures of it and started sending it to his friends. It was a lot of fun. So one thing that really struck me about the conversation with Ennis was his emphasis on how passionate athletes are about their faith. I think on the podcast, he talks about, how the different locker rooms have player-led Bible studies, how they're players who spend their only free time during halftime just reading scripture, and how much he's learned about different players' faith journeys. And we're not talking like scrubs. We're talking about some of the biggest players in the league, Steph Curry, Jimmy Butler. And I think when it comes down to it, what's so fascinating in Ennis's case is that, listen, lots of players in the league get involved in activism. And I think, like, in general, sort of like activism is like a trendy thing for celebrities to do. So there's a great show called The Other Two with Drew Tarver and a couple other people about celebrity and growing up adjacent to celebrity. And one of the funny lines in the show is, you know, the main characters, who are a bunch of schlubs, are talking to these like three very trendy, you know, big time influencers on Instagram. And the Instagrammers are like in their 20s and they're like, yeah, we're retired. And they're like, you're retired, you're in your 20s. Like, yeah, your teens are for working, your 20s are for being retired and having fun. And then they're like, well, what are your 30s for? And in unison, they're like, for changing the world. So they're like, for making a global impact. And so I think like activism is very trendy for celebrities, but what's interesting for Ennis is that because his engagement on that front is driven by his faith and by his values and something kind of bigger than his own individual interests. So it takes him into places that would otherwise for someone of his profession and station be very unpopular. So you can see like the activism against the Chinese Communist Party and oppression against Uyghurs and the subjugation of Hong Kong and the threatened subjugation of Taiwan are all things that are kind of verboten in an MBA context. And yet Ennis is doing them because he's driven by his values as a person of faith. I thought that was fascinating.
Very interesting. Well, Rabbi Ari Lamb from B'nai Tzion, it was great to have you on the Jerusalem Post podcast. We hope to have you again soon.
Thank you so much. It was a great pleasure, and I'm a big fan.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Jerusalem Post podcast. Great to have you with us. Please share widely with all your friends. We're on all the different platforms, and we'll see you next week.